Welcome to Stateside, and happy Wednesday, everyone. I'm Cynthia Canty. High schools all across Michigan are turning out fewer graduates. So with the graduate pool shrinking, colleges and universities are forced to search for ways to make up the gap. We'll find out more on today's show. And then rebounding home values in Michigan mean that more people might be able to tap into quick cash through home equity loans. But that might not necessarily be such a good thing. But first, let's begin the hour in Lansing. That's where last night the state Senate approved legislation extending Medicaid benefits to hundreds of thousands of Michigan residents. The measure initially failed when it didn't get the 20 votes it needed to pass. But then the chamber agreed to reconsider the bill, and it passed, with Republican Senator Tom Casperson switching his vote to yes. Governor Snyder praised the Senate for moving the bill forward.
So now we're going to have an opportunity, hopefully with House passage, to move forward in terms of taking care of many hundreds of thousands of Michiganders. And we all know someone that falls in that category. Hardworking people, but lower-income people that couldn't afford health insurance.
Joining us now is Rick Pluta, Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network, who joins us from the Capitol. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Cindy.
So the state Senate passed the Medicaid expansion, and as the governor said, now the legislation goes back to the House. So give us a sense of what's going to happen now.
Well, like you said, it goes back to the House. It could be voted on as soon as next week. That if they think that the votes are there, they're not going to want to wait on this. We do know that the Republican-led House did pass it earlier this summer. Like the Senate, it took a majority of Democrats with some Republicans coming along to make it happen. When the Senate did not quickly follow suit, which was what expected, there were some hard feelings left over. But, you know, House Speaker Jace Bolger did issue a statement following the Senate action saying, you know, praising this legislation as an improvement. And so even though, you know, nothing is certain and it's not over until it's over, right now there seems to be a pretty high degree of confidence that this will be passed by the House, and that would clear the way to send it to Governor Rick Snyder's desk, except there is this one other wrinkle lying out there.
And that wrinkle is immediate effect. Now, this is what, a procedural vote that determines when a law is actually enacted, and the Senate did not vote to give this bill, the Medicaid expansion bill, immediate effect. So that would mean the expansion could be delayed from January until April. Can you explain this for us?
Well, possibly April. The Michigan Constitution says that most laws are going to be enacted 90 days after the last day of the session, of the legislature's session of the year. The idea was that the framers of the state constitution didn't want to spring laws on people and businesses without giving them time to get ready for them. And so the idea was that, well, if we give them, you know, 3 months until the end of the session, then, you know, that's enough time. But there are going to be some instances where you don't want to wait that long. Mm-hmm. Maybe you want to make it, you know, go into effect right away to meet some kind of an emergency. Maybe you just want to not have to wait that long for the law to pass. And so what the framers allowed is by supermajorities, two-thirds votes, that the legislature could give a measure immediate effect, which allows it to go into effect, you know, as the name implies, you know, right away. So that's where this stands. The majority by which this bill cleared the Senate was not two-thirds. It wasn't 24 votes, 25 votes. And they weren't able to get it for that separate procedural vote. So now it's sitting with the House, and that leaves the Snyder administration with a problem.
And the problem is?
The problem is about a $630 million problem if the legislature does not adjourn until the end of the year and it takes until early spring for the new law to take effect. What the Snyder administration was counting on was that we would start covering more people under the Medicaid expansion starting on January 1st. No immediate effect, no January 1st enactment date, no Medicaid expansion until the spring. The price tag on that, the administration says, is $7 million a day. That adds up to $630 million for the first 3 months of the year. And that's money that the state would never make up, because under the federal health care law, starting on January 1st, you're eligible for your federal funds, but they don't They don't give you more at the end if you didn't sign up on time.
No retroactive goodies for slowpokes.
Right.
Are there any options to try to push this up from April to anything earlier?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of different ways that the machinations could go. You know, the House could decide to delay its vote to give the Senate time to take up the legislation again, or at least the motion for immediate effect on the Medicaid expansion. You know, one thing that they could conceivably do is if they can get their work done by the end of the of September, that would be a heavy lift because there are still some contentious issues out there. They could adjourn for the year at the end of September. That would start the clock ticking, and that would get the Medicaid expansion started on January 1st. That's one of those things that's very often talked about when you're facing a problem like this. I've never actually seen that happen, though.
Well, obviously an issue that we will be watching closely with your help. Rick Pluta, Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network. Rick, thanks so much.
Oh, my pleasure, Cindy.
Don't let a snub from ESPN keep you down. That could be the motto of my next two guests. We last spoke with Garrett Kohler and Kevin Kreese as they led the campaign to get ESPN to choose Detroit for the new site of the Summer X Games, a campaign that ended with ESPN choosing Austin, Texas over the Motor City. But Garrett and Kevin have already come up with a reboot, a new idea for a downtown festival called Assemble. Kevin Kreese, founder and director of Action Sports Detroit, welcome back.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. And joined by managing partner Garrett Kohler. Hi, Garrett.
Hey, how are you?
Good to have you with us. So, Kevin, when you learned ESPN had awarded the X Games to Austin, Texas, over Detroit and Chicago and Charlotte, did you take that a little personally?
We did not take it personally. You know, when we started this process, we knew that Austin was our fiercest competitor and that the only way that we could beat them would really be about changing the game and the story, and that's really what we attempted to do.
And Garrett, you wasted no time coming up with something new. Tell us, what's Assemble?
Yeah, so Assemble is essentially the festival that we had been pitching the entire time, right? Because we had been pitching ESPN on this more holistic vision of their current product, one that truly integrates the sports competitions, the best sports competitions around with a music festival, with art, and we're adding another element too called Idea.
So sports, noise, idea, and form. What do you envision this festival looking like and feeling like, Kevin?
Well, you know, the work that we did on the X Games bid, we're able to transfer a lot of that work into what we're doing now. And because a lot of it's about creating relationships with people that know how to work in the downtown Detroit space. And so we're still going to build out a downtown festival that's going to use all different spaces in the city to activate in different ways surrounding these four different elements. So we're going to be building out different skate parks, BMX parks, creating a rallycross race in the city, also doing more of this idea contest of trying to support entrepreneurship in the city, and then also activating street art and other types of art in the city space annually.
I had to like a piece that Alan Stamm wrote in Deadline Detroit, and he described Assemble as sort of an arts beats and eats with skateboards instead of sandwiches. Does that sound pretty fair?
That would be really unfair, actually.
Okay.
We're actually trying to build the top skateboard, BMX, and rallycross competition in the U.S. So that would be actually the antithesis of what we're doing. We're working with partners around the country that are really excited to participate in a Detroit event. And we're talking about production values that are, you know, the same, if not better than, you know, what we were going to produce at ESPN. So we're really looking to do something that's never been done in the city before. And we're pretty confident about it.
When do you think you'll have ideas on sponsors and partners and tentative dates?
You know, right now we're working on getting all the tentative relationships in place to execute this event. Our primary focus has been content. We have a content-first approach, and the idea is that if we can build on the momentum that we created with the X Games movement and really harness that for the purpose of finding partners who are passionate about creating relevant content in Detroit, the sponsors will all follow. So, you know, the first phase we think will take us through mid-September, and then we can start talking about sponsorships.
So we'll be hearing more as this all comes together. And you certainly showed us you can reboot and rebound and do it very, very quickly after a disappointment.
Well, you know, we didn't even view it as much of a disappointment. Now we have a lot more control to create something that really speaks to the community here, and that's completely new. So we're excited to work on it.
Kevin Kreese and Garrett Kohler of Action Sports Detroit talking about plans for the upcoming Assemble Festival, hopefully in 2014. Keep us posted, guys.
Yeah, thanks so much for having us.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, the headlines are very clear. Home prices still going strong. We've watched Michigan home prices, by and large, climbing back up from the depths of the Great Recession. Here's a for instance. Detroit area home prices, 16% higher than just a year ago, according to the Standard & Poor's Case-Shiller Home Price Index. What that means is that in the six counties of southeast Michigan, home prices are at a level not seen since 2008. And word from West Michigan, home sales are chugging along even as the big summer home sales season winds down. Realtors in West Michigan say their big challenge, finding enough listings to meet the demand. Rebounding home values means more people are able to tap into quick cash through home equity loans. But Detroit Free Press personal finance columnist Susan Tomport has a warning if you're eyeing a home equity loan, and that warning is, be careful. Susan, welcome back to Stateside, and you have a clear warning?
Yes, it's not always going to be easy to get that home equity loan or line of credit, but that might be a good thing because back in the go-go days, that was how we were papering our debt and getting into lots and lots of trouble. So the lenders are going to be a little bit more cautious, but you still might be able to use some of these lines to maybe pay off some debt. We interviewed one woman who was going to get a new driveway. So it's pragmatic things, not like just going to Disney World on your home equity.
Prospects have improved, haven't they?
They have improved. They have improved quite a bit because the home values are there. You can't obviously take out a home equity loan if there's no equity. Mark Zandi, chief economist at Moody's Analytics, told me that the Federal Reserve data right now shows that homeowners' equity nationwide is up $2.6 trillion, and that's by an increase of about 40% through March compared with the bottom that was in the second quarter of 2011. So obviously we're picking up on some values here. This increase, Zandi told me, is driven both by the rising home prices, but also, you know, there's some mortgage defaults in there, which is going to reduce the amount of debt outstanding.
Mm.
So you do have this upswing in equity. Some of the lenders are in the early stages. One of the reasons I first started writing about this is that Discover is getting back into the home equity loan business. They're marketing that to their customers. But, you know, when you see a lender coming back into the business, that's always a little bit of good news.
So could we say overall home equity loans would be an attractive option for families, say, looking to pay a college tuition bill or to pay down their credit cards?
It can be a good option. You should compare on a college loan, though. The first thing you're going to obviously want to do is work on those. We've talked about this, you and I, before, on that federal education loan. Those are the best because there's all sorts of, incentives there. The rates are still pretty good. You know, you don't just want to jumpstart and go into the equity. You do need to remember if you default on a home equity loan or line of credit, you know, you've got more troubles than with a student loan.
Yeah.
So, you know, so that's an issue. And there's some tax breaks here, of course, for many people on these home equity loans. So it is another option that you can consider. Two things you really want to know is you're going to have an appraisal, and you won't be able to take out as much money as you maybe had in the past. We give you a pretty good example in my column at the Free Press, which is still online. But if you took a home valued at $100,000, just using round numbers,
mm-hmm.
And then say the mortgage was $70,000, you might think, oh, I could get a line of credit, you know, for $30,000. No, that's not the way that's going to go. It's not simple math. The homeowner is only going to be able to borrow $10,000 in that example, and some lenders aren't doing them as small as $10,000. Some lenders are only going to want to do $25,000 for a home equity loan or higher. So it's going to depend on how much equity. Right now, the experts are saying that the lenders want the homeowner to retain 20% equity in the house even after that first mortgage and taking out a home equity line of credit. Obviously, the reason is they got burned last time, right?
In fact, we're seeing this everywhere. I know just from personal experience and friends who have gone through it, even if you're trying to go through a home sale, it's a different world out there. There is so much more that's demanded in terms of documentation and this and that. So you're seeing the same kind of caution on behalf of the lenders when it comes to home equity offers.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, some it just depends if you're able to qualify for a refinancing. Say you didn't get that 3.5% rate, you know, you might still look at refinancing your mortgage, but instead of doing a home equity line, you know, to take some equity out. But right now, the experts are saying, you know, the folks at Bankrate.com are saying things like, well, you know, many people can't tap out the equity in the home because they've got a low rate. So if you've got a low rate of 3.5, you're not going to want to, you know, refinance. Right now, the folks at Bankrate.com said on a 30-year mortgage, the average is about 4.74%, but that's up from December, which was 3.5%, you know, an average there. So it's been ticking upward, you know, on the 30-year mortgage rate. The question is, you know, will it come back down a little bit here? Mm-hmm. The Fed is supposedly going to try to, you know, tinker with things. You know, so you don't really know where the rates are going to go. But right now the rates aren't too bad to do some of that home equity lending. And what they're saying, too, is you really want to shop around because the community banks, credit unions, they're showing some renewed interest. So maybe if you see a advertisement from a big national company, you want to compare it with maybe the smaller bank or the credit union that's in your area. And, you know, with credit unions, I want to make out one, you know, point here. A lot of times people think, oh, you have to work at a certain company to belong to a credit union. A lot of those restrictions are gone. They left many years ago.
So if you look at the whole situation, Susan, and even looking ahead, does it feel like the housing prices and home equity possibilities, would you call it rosy, or what term would you use?
Boy, we would like to call it rosy, wouldn't we? That's where we would like to say, hey, it's great.
Yeah.
you know, I'm hard. It's hard for me to tell because listening to the different reports, you hear two different things, and it may be a two-tiered kind of a market for housing. You hear the first-time home buyer is having to come up with a 20% down payment. It's much harder to do. You know, that's where some of these issues may come into play. Is it a better home, you know, that it might be for a boomer who's trading up that you're trying to sell? Because maybe that home's, you know, value will go up a little bit. We aren't at the bottom anymore, obviously, from the numbers that we're hearing about, from the increases in prices. We're not at the bottom, but many are warning that this pace could be slowing, and many are warning that, you know, maybe some of the certain homes in certain markets or sizes, you know, it's still going to be hard for a younger person to buy a home with all that student loan debt. So, you know, it just will depend on the size of the house and the location. But the good news is, you know, that we have come back quite a bit. The question is, what does that mean when they say the pace may be slowing? You know, does it still mean we're going to see some growth? I guess the thing to think about is if you're an investor and you're thinking, oh, I'm going to double my money on this house in 2 or 3 years, you know, that's probably crazy. That's probably not going to happen.
Well, and as you say in your headline, be careful. Detroit Free Press personal finance columnist Susan Tompor. Always good talking with you, Susan. Thanks for your time.
Great to talk to you, too. Thanks.
It is no secret. The Great Recession took a huge toll on the population of Michigan. Our state population dropped for 6 straight years, finally leveled out from 2010-2011, and then increased slightly from 2011 to 2012. For many cities and many neighborhoods, the post-recession challenge is getting new life, new residents back into vacant homes. One Detroit neighborhood is succeeding in that challenge, the Grandmont-Rosedale area. It's actually made up of 5 smaller areas on Detroit's west side. They're attracting new homeowners. And the Grandmont-Rosedale Development Corporation reports that of the last 25 homes sold in the area, 14 were bought by suburbanites moving into the city. So we wanted to find out what neighborhoods all around Michigan can learn from Grandmont-Rosedale. As we say hello to Tom Godiris, he's the executive director of the Grandmont-Rosedale Development Corporation. Tom, give us a sense of how well homes are selling in Grandmont-Rosedale.
Well, they're selling very quickly. One of the things that our organization does is purchase vacant houses, renovates them, and then sells them to new homeowners. And we're finding buyers for our homes really as soon as we can get them finished. So I would say that if a home is renovated and or even just move-in ready, there are buyers lined up to buy those homes.
And you're getting folks from not just other Detroit neighborhoods, but from the suburbs as well?
Yes. So it surprised us a little bit, too, I'd say. In the last few years, a lot of our buyers are people looking to move into Detroit. Some people maybe were once in Detroit and moved away and are moving back. Others are just attracted by the idea of being part of the revitalization of the city.
Are these older folks? Are they empty nesters? Are they young couples beginning their lives? What's a typical buyer, or is there a typical buyer?
Not necessarily a typical buyer, but there are a lot of our buyers are younger people, singles, couples, and young families who are want to move into the city, want to be part of Detroit. And one of the exciting things that I see is that our buyers are now reaching out to their friends and their acquaintances, and they're helping us market the neighborhood themselves. You know, so they're bringing more people like them, think like them, and want to be part of the city and part of a diverse community.
I'm curious how you meet, Tom, the challenges in selling your neighborhood, especially in Detroit, because we all know there's that perception that people are fleeing Detroit, that city services aren't available, police don't come. When you call, how do you combat that perception?
In terms of our community, we have active neighborhood residents who are trying to address all of those issues the best we can. You know, I think people understand that there are challenges of moving into Detroit. I think a lot of folks are seeing that the value that they can buy in a house in a neighborhood like ours, there's a trade-off there. They may, pay a little extra on certain things, but they're getting so much house for their money. But I would say that our typical buyer, they don't view themselves as someone who lives in the suburbs. They want to be part of the city, and they see the future of Detroit as brighter and the future of the region as needing a strong central city.
Now, Grandmont Rosedale Development Corporation, your group, is really getting credit for getting out there and marketing the neighborhood. We wanted to share your story, Tom, and what's being done in Grandmont Rosedale so other cities and neighborhoods in Michigan could learn from what you're finding that works. I guess I'm wondering what advice would you give to folks listening, other neighborhoods and other cities and parts of Michigan about developing that brand and marketing themselves?
Well, I think, if you're marketing anything, whether it's a neighborhood or a product or anything, you have to figure out what are the real strengths and assets of your community and what is the appeal that your neighborhood has when compared to other choices that people have about where they want to move and where they want to live. And then just really focus in on that message and make sure that, you know, people understand it and know about who you are and what you have to offer. I mean, we still, in our neighborhood, have that problem of the general perception of the city, and so folks come and see our neighborhood, and they say, oh, you know, I didn't know there was such a nice neighborhood in Detroit. Mm. And so you're still kind of combating the general perception that might be out there in the media. So you have to make sure that people understand what is it about your community that is unique and what gives it a high quality of life and what would make that a good choice for that home buyer.
Tom Godiris, the executive director of the Grandmont Rosedale Development Corporation. Thanks for talking with us today, Tom.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Trying to reverse climate change one cloned tree at a time. That's the mission of my next guest. David Mylark co-founded Archangel Ancient Tree Archive in 2008, based in northern Lower Michigan. His vision is to spread the genetics of the world's remaining ancient forests. His work attracted the attention of journalist and science writer Jim Robbins, and the result was the book The Man Who Planted Trees, Lost Groves, Champion Trees, and an Urgent Plan to Save the Planet. The Man Who Planted Trees joins us now. It's good to have you with us, David.
It's an honor to be here. Thank you.
Tell us, what is the Archangel Ancient Tree Archive? It's the most intriguing name.
Well, it used to be the Champion Tree Project, and 4 years ago, we changed its name to Archangel Ancient Trees, and we're cloning the largest and oldest living things on Earth, and of course, that's trees. We're archiving their genetics, and we're making millions of these trees available to reforest this planet with supergroves that will go after climate change.
Now, just how do you go about cloning trees?
That's a good question. First, you have to find them. It's tough to find the largest and oldest of its species, but we do. We send climbers to those trees. They climb the trees, bring the living tissue down, and we overnight it to our lab, and we ask those trees that are several hundred or several thousand years old to please clone themselves so that we can preserve the last genetics of these great trees and utilize them to reforest the planet, rebuild the watershed ecosystems.
Why are these ancient trees so important? What do they give us that we aren't getting from newer species?
Well, those clone trees have the exact genetic fingerprint of an unbroken string of 10 thousands of years of survival of the fittest of the species of trees. We've gone into the forest here in Michigan and all over the country and the world, as a matter of fact, and four or five times we've gone into all forests and cut down the best of the best and left the junk. And when you high-grade a forest several times, like we have, or clear-cut it and leave the junk, the genetic fingerprint of those trees, of the junk of the junk of the junk, is not trees that we need to have working for us at this period when we're heading so deeply into the climate change scenario we find ourselves.
You've cloned about 130 different species in the U.S. and 40 species of the largest and best trees in Michigan. How do you choose which species you want to clone?
Well, we look at primarily our urban forests because that's where the ecosystem damage has been the most severe, almost totally eradicated. So we say which champion trees are the biggest, best trees, native trees to that region would do best to help shift that watershed ecosystem back to a natural state, pull out the toxins in the water and the air, and then also, which are the best carbon sequestration species of trees that we could use here in Michigan or whatever region we work in.
How did this become such a passion for you?
I think through fear for my grandchildren and the grandchildren of the world, really, and our two sons. Also, I looked down the road and I didn't see science as a whole, academics, or the governments of the world, or anybody really trying to find viable solutions to help reverse or change this climate change scenario, which so many scientists have been talking about since the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
It was ignored, swept under the rug. And maybe someday we'll change our fossil fuel addiction and a lot of the things that we all take for granted. In the meantime, Rome was burning. So as I tried to find groups or organizations or government organizations that were really finding viable solutions, I didn't find any. So I said to my two sons, we better do something about this and let's give it all that we have.
David Millar co-founded Archangel Ancient Tree Archive, and the website is ancienttreearchive.org for the Archangel Ancient Tree Archive. David, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been a real honor and a pleasure.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Many colleges and universities in Michigan are facing kind of a double whammy. They've been grappling with ways to fill the revenue hole after the state legislature cut funding for higher ed as the state's economy went into freefall. And now comes the latest challenge. High schools across the state are turning out fewer graduates. With the graduate pool shrinking, most colleges and universities are searching for ways to make up that gap. So what does this all mean for Michigan colleges and for prospective students? Well, joining us is the Director of Policy Research at the Western Interstate Commission on Higher Education, Brian Prescott. And joining us from Mount Pleasant is the Director of Admissions for Central Michigan University, Thomas Speakman. Brian, I want to start with you because earlier this year, your organization released a major report called Knocking at the College Door, and it found Michigan is second only to California in the decreasing number of high school graduates. What's happening in our state?
Well, basically, our projections are they start with the number of births that happened about 18 years ago. And so what you're seeing in Michigan is a product of a number of factors. But first and foremost, it's part of a pattern that happened almost two decades ago, more or less all the way across the country. And, you know, at the end of the baby boom echoes generation happened back then. And we've just started to see the results of that declining. But in addition to that, with all of the economic problems that have been widely reported across the country occurring in Michigan, there's been a fairly substantial exodus of folks who live there and into other parts of the country. So places in the South and places in the West most typically have been benefiting from folks leaving the state of Michigan and also other states in the Northeast. And so that's the combination of those factors are the principal reasons why the number of high school graduates in Michigan is declining.
So what I'm hearing is basically the fertility era ended for the baby boomers. So our kids are all moving out of high school. And so that has left a gap.
Right.
And the bad economy has sent people south and west. So for folks like you, Tom Speakman, whose job is to get those freshman bodies into classrooms each fall, what challenges has that presented for you at Central Michigan?
Well, certainly, Cindy and Brian, it's caused us to look outside our borders. And one of the initiatives that we're looking at expanding our geographic footprint would be to put more troops on the ground, so to speak, in Indiana, Illinois, Ohio, Wisconsin, some of the contiguous states, and actually spend more time recruiting out of state, hoping to drive students into Michigan. We're also offering academic scholarships to out-of-state students, as well as in-state tuition rates. So, for instance, a student that performs well outside of Michigan would qualify for an in-state tuition rate. We're also looking at sort of diversifying the portfolio. Veterans have been a real staple of our enrollment, and so we're looking at increasing our veteran student enrollments. Probably for the first time in quite a while, we're looking at international students. We're also trying to partner with some of the high schools with dual enrollment programs to get high school students, good high school students in 11th and 12th grade, to supplement their high school education by taking college-level coursework through CMU. Also looking at reverse transfer agreements through the community colleges, where a student would come to CMU, go back to the community college, and then come back to CMU to finish the degree. So, yes, we are challenged, but I think we're looking at the challenge as a positive opportunity and basically expanding our outreach.
Brian Prescott, from what you're seeing in your report and in your studies, how well do you think these strategies that we heard from Tom will work to help bolster the incoming freshman population?
Well, I think that one of the challenges that comes with doing that is that surrounding Michigan are a whole bunch of other states that will see their high school graduating population shrink as well. And so Michigan's just sort of got the brunt of what's going on in that part of the country, but it's now going to be competing with other institutions very much like it for the same students that is a smaller proportion of it. And it remains to be seen to what extent the admissions hysteria that has characterized the last 20 years nearly, in which every year there's been a larger number of high school graduates in virtually every state across the country, that era is just now ending. But now we might see the tables turned a little bit on the colleges, where they're now competing more heavily over the fewer students that are available using many of the same tools and techniques that Tom just mentioned. We're hearing a lot more about non-resident recruitment, international recruitment, and the like. The one thing I did hear just now that I think is real positive is outreach to the veteran community and to communities that aren't being served nearly as well as perhaps they might have been in the past. Along with all of these, the changes in just the total numbers is this rapid diversification along racial ethnic lines as well.
And the fastest growing population in virtually every state is the Hispanic population. And they obviously are a group that higher education has not always been as effective at serving. And so I think one of the approaches that states and institutions are really going to have to think hard about is how to reach the population that is growing at particularly fast rates. And we'll see how that turns out. But many of the things that Tom just mentioned are strategies that I've heard a great deal about in the traipsing around that I do. But I should mention that, unlike Tom, I don't have the responsibility of actually making all of these numbers come out
one thing,
the balance sheet.
One thing I don't know if I heard, and correct me if I'm wrong, is you kind of spelled out strategies, Tom Speakman, as Director of Admissions for Central Michigan University. How important would be adult students, the non-traditional students, who perhaps always harbored the hopes of getting a degree? Does that fit in the plan somewhere?
Absolutely. I think adult learners are a subset of the transfer student population. They'll also be a subset of the veteran student population. They're also a significant part of our global online community that CMU has. So I think what you're going to see is sort of a shifting in the percentage of traditional age students and adult learning students at CMU. And I would agree, that is another part. The other piece that we're looking at, and I did not mention, but Brian sort of alluded to that, reaching our Hispanic, Latino, African American population, really looking at developing strong summer bridge programs mm-hmm. so that students coming from high school that, you know, demonstrate that they can clearly successfully navigate college coursework, but need some support, need some help to get off to a good start, developing those bridge programs in the summer. And that's something we're actually discussing right now, is the size and the number of summer bridge students we want to bring to CMU.
It strikes me that many of these students, these bridge students, and when we're looking at this increased diversity, a lot of those folks don't have probably what we might say a lot of money and are going to need help. And that comes at a time when you're coping with rising college costs and less support from Lansing. So it seems that there's kind of a catch-22 at play here.
Well, I would agree. Certainly many would perhaps qualify for the Pell Grant and additional need-based financial aid supports. But you're correct. We're also going to need to develop some institutional support for those students that are coming through the bridge programs.
That was Tom Speakman, who was speaking to us, Director of Admissions for Central Michigan University. And we're also talking with Brian Prescott, who's with the Western Interstate Commission on Higher Education, known as WICHE, and their report looking at the fact that there's a major decrease in the number of high school graduates, particularly here in Michigan, and what does that mean for colleges ahead. And one of the things that you say in your report is that colleges are going to have to address rising costs. Haven't they had to do that? I mean, how much do you cut before you've destroyed what makes that college special? And they've had to do that already, as Lansing's support has reduced. So, what's the solution from where you sit, Brian Prescott? Yeah,
wow.
Wave that magic wand, right?
Right. That's the $64,000 question.
Literally.
Right. So, you know, I think that what we're facing a situation now in the wake of the recession, but it was coming perhaps even without having had the recessionary effects that we've all been trying to deal with, in which we're facing in higher education a little bit of a new normal, and there's going to be some tough adjustments to that, but it's characterized by increased pressure on the part of public policymakers and the public to generate well-qualified individuals for employment, coupled with this diversification and decline in the traditional populations that higher education institutions have generally served well, and with these really severe fiscal constraints that colleges and universities have had to wrestle with over the last really 15 years, but especially in the last five. In many ways, what you're hearing Tom say and what we say in our rounds is that there's going to have to be some changes to business as usual. Some of these strategies that Tom mentioned are principally about recruitment, but in terms of how serving students more effectively and more productively will need to change. There's been a tremendous amount of attention nationally on changing the way in which public finance makes its way to college and university budgets. There's a movement to rethink financial aid at the state level, at the federal level. I don't know to what extent that's come on any sort of coherent way to institutional aid, but I think the time is coming to think about that as well. I think one of the things that would be helpful is that, and I think one of the things we're going to struggle with, is that we've grown accustomed to, and perhaps we've grown addicted to, being able to tell our alumni and our publics, however they defined, that every year we've been able to recruit a more qualified group of students to enroll at our institutions. And I know that the institutions that are my alma maters routinely send me things that talk about rankings, and they talk about the extent to which that my alma maters have valedictorians and high SAT score earners and so forth. One wonders whether or not it's time to start thinking differently about how we measure quality, both in terms and what we want out of our public institutions, and to what extent do we want to really serve the residents of our state, who are going to be, on average, less well prepared, mm-hmm. by and large, because by nature of the pool being smaller, and probably have less income on hand to be able to afford the costs of college as they go up.
How does that echo with the conversations you're having at Central, Tom Speakman?
Well, I certainly agree with everything that Brian has shared. I think one of the things that we're looking at is retention. And so certainly cost to a student having to go 5 years versus four, there's a significant savings if the student can graduate in 4 years. So one would be implementing strategies, academic advising, trimming the number of credits the student has to complete to finish a degree in 4 years would certainly save in tuition costs, moving five-year programs to four-year programs. The other piece is, quite frankly, and I know Brian touched on this as well, you know, as we're becoming more of a private school, even though we're a public institution, we're beginning to look at students not only for merit-based aid, but then look further and see what is their need. And so scholarship and financial aid packages are becoming more combined merit and need-based, mm-hmm. so that we can enroll the students with the right financial aid package. And that's sort of a private school model, so we are sort of going in that direction as well.
Could there be a winner in this competition for students among Michigan colleges and universities?
I believe the winner will be the public. Certainly, it's requiring, as Brian has shared, you know, institutions to, you know, sort of cease and desist the way they've always done business and to look to be more creative and to be more student-centered and student-focused. And to make themselves attractive to students, and not just traditional age students, multicultural students, veterans, international students, transfer students, adult learners. And so the winner, in my view, clearly will be the population that we're trying to recruit.
And Brian, your final thoughts, especially, you know, looking at what you found and realizing how greatly the high school graduation population is going to be shrinking in the next 15 years to fewer than 90,000 from our peak of 123,000 plus. Where do you see Michigan colleges and universities, let's say 20 years out as this plays out?
Well, you know, I think first and foremost, the situation facing Michigan colleges and universities is bound up in part with the state of the economy in Michigan. And so, you know, I think part of my answer to that question would depend on how, to what extent Michigan's able to get its economy turned around and to have larger in-migration numbers than to reverse the pattern of people leaving, I should
mm-hmm,
say.
Mm-hmm.
And if that happens, then, you know, some of what Michigan public institutions are going to be going through over the next several years as they try to deal with this decline and try to change business as usual, try to change some of the rhetoric around what we think matters in higher education, I think then that puts Michigan colleges and universities well positioned to serve the public more effectively, especially as prices have risen and expectations are that folks be able to pay off the debt that they incur as they pay higher tuition prices. Michigan institutions may be better positioned if they have those conversations for students to graduate and be able to find employment in order to afford the costs that they've brought on. But I think that I'm hopeful, and part of what I'm hopeful about is that we can begin to have a more honest conversation around what it is that we want out of colleges and universities and how we want to pay for that. And instead of what we've been having, which is in large part policy drift, because we've often viewed higher education as a very private good, and we haven't considered what it really means to have a public institution serving a state public. And I think that conversation needs to be coming, and we need to have a conversation around that honestly. And in Michigan, facing the particular big declines in the traditional student population, maybe the conditions may be ripe for that kind of conversation.
That was Brian Prescott, who's the Director of Policy Research at the Western Interstate Commission on Higher Education. He spoke to us today from Boulder, Colorado. And from Mount Pleasant, we were speaking to the Director of Admissions for Central Michigan University, Thomas Speakman, getting ready for a new school year. Thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you very much.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Bob Skon. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Mercedes Mejia, and Katie Suha. This program's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.